Hello, I'm Mark Stein, and welcome. Good to have you all with us today. And before we leap into our subject of banned books in our state and around the nation, in this ban, this is Banned Books Week, let me tell you this day in history, September the 24th. This is the day in 1973 that Guinea-Bissau became independent from Portugal after a long revolutionary struggle. It's the day in 1725, those of you who like to sip the dark brew, this is the day that Sir Arthur Guinness, the Irish brewer, was born in 1725. This is a day in 1825 when Frances Ellen Watkins Harper was born. Now, I bet many of you never heard of Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. People don't know who she is for the most part. She was born in Baltimore. She became one of the most powerful literary figures in the 19th century, but you don't know about her because she's a black woman who wrote poetry and wrote short stories. She was born in the city. She became the first woman to teach sewing in this institute, but more importantly, she became one of the leaders of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, worked in the Underground Railroad, helped people flee from slavery, at great risk to her own life, got people to Canada from the South. She wrote a widely praised book that, when she was 67, called Iola, that nobody knows about anymore. She was a public speaker. She wrote poems called Poems on Miscellaneous Subjects. She wrote a book of short stories published in the Anglo-African in 1859 called Two Offers. She wrote this incredible book that I know about called Sketches of a Southern Life in 1872, where she went south to talk to interview people who had just been freed from slavery and talked about the harsh and miserable conditions people lived under in post-slavery America. She was the founder of the National Association of Colored Women. She was their vice president. She was a person who worked in the women's movement to get the women's right to vote. And was the superintendent of black schools in Philadelphia for a long time. She died in Philadelphia in 1911, 9 years before the women got the right to vote. But she was an incredible figure in our history, born right here in Baltimore, and we don't even acknowledge who she is really any longer, but we do here. This is also the birthday of somebody else we should acknowledge who was also born in Baltimore, Dr. E. Franklin Frazier. Edmund Franklin Frazier was born on this day in 1894. And this is a man who upset and turned upside down scholarship in America. He wrote the book that many people know about, but most people haven't read, but you need to read, which is called Black Bourgeoisie, that he wrote in 1957. But he turned the kind of academic world upside down by talking about the black family and how slavery affected black families in America into the modern era because of the dislocation of black family, not just from welfare, but from the roots in slavery, and was a very powerful thinker who stood up to UEC, was labeled a traitor and a communist because he wouldn't name names. He was a stand-up human being and one of the most brilliant scholars America's ever created. He was born on this day in Baltimore as well, E. Franklin Frazier. This was the day in 1891 that John Adams Hyman, North Carolina's first black congressman, died in Washington, D.C. On this day in 622, the Prophet Muhammad completed his hijrah, which was his flight from Mecca to Medina to escape prosecution. And it was that flight that actually founded the nation, the religion of Islam that he organized to defend Arabians and more. And that it was on this day in 622 that it happened. This was the day in 1789, the Judiciary Act was passed by Congress under George Washington that created the Supreme Court. This is the day in 1890, the Mormon Church officially renounces polygamy so that Utah could come into the Union. Though I just a little added irony to all that, it was actually the polygamous women who led the fight for women's rights in Wyoming and Utah. Most folks don't realize that. It's a contradiction of history. We can talk about another day. This is the day that in 1908 the first factory-built Model T was completed, known as Tin Lizzy. This is the day that 1935 the boxer Joe Louis became the first African-American boxer to draw more than a $1 million purse. This is the day that in 1958 that the auto workers almost went on strike and they began striking across America for higher wages. Walkouts took place all over the place on a daily basis, 30,000 on strike at GM, 15,000 on strike at Chrysler. Maybe our workers today could take a little lesson from the workers back then. Sometimes you got to stand up to get what you need. This is the last episode in 1961 of I Love Lucy that aired. One of the funniest women in America, Lucille Ball, I think. This is the day that 1962, the U.S. Court of Appeals ordered the admittance of James Meredith to the University of Mississippi. This is the day in 1964 the Warren Commission came out saying that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was done by one man, not a conspiracy, but blasted Dallas for not protecting him, and has been a controversy ever since, whether it's a conspiracy or not. This is the day that 60 Minutes was born in 1968, the great investigative TV show that once was a great investigative TV show. Now it's like all the rest. This is the day that the Chicago 8 went on trial in 1969 that we talked about yesterday. This is the day that Ian Douglas Smith, Rhodesian Prime Minister, was forced to say he was going to have a multiracial government, which is the beginning of the end of his government. This is the day in 1977 that Robert Chambliss, the white supremacist, was finally charged for the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, we spent so much time talking about last week. And this is the day, in 2007 that the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, was speaking at Columbia University and went to a confrontation with the president of Columbia University then, Lee Bollinger, who called him a cruel dictator. And they went back and forth. And Ahmadinejad, when he was pushed about executing homosexuals in Iran, said, "In Iran, we don't have homosexuals like that in our country," announcing it's the only country on the planet Earth with no gay people in it. But it's interesting if you look today that we are seeing a different thing happen that we'll be talking about tomorrow, that President Barack Obama and the Prime Minister of Rouhani of Iran may be meeting together face-to-face. So we'll see what all that portends for the future of this planet. That's this day in history, September the 24th. We are joined here, Dr. Carla Hayden's in the studio, Chief Executive Officer of our Enoch Pratt Free Library. And as a disclaimer and full transparency, I am on the board of Enoch Pratt, which is not why Dr. Hayden's here, but because we're talking about books, and that's what she does. Good to have you in the studio, Carla.
Banned books, too. And it was wonderful to hear you talk about Francis Harper and E. Franklin Frazier, and especially in the context of books that have been banned and challenged.
Right.
And her books people aren't even able to find out about these people.
They wouldn't put her books in white schools at all. Dr. Barbara Jones is with us by phone. She's director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association. Dr. Barbara Jones, welcome. David Rocha, good to have you back in the studio. ACLU Maryland Senior Staff Attorney.
Great to be here.
And Krista Daring's with us. She's publicist at AK Press, collective member at Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffeehouse, co-editor of the book Queering Anarchism. And Krista, good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me today.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Along on to our Facebook pages, the Mark Steiner Show page or Mark Steiner, and I'll see what you have to say. Or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on banned books. Banned books. Carla Hayden, is a complex subject.
It's very complex, but it also, I think, points to so many things that are wonderful about books and reading, and that you can, the fact that so many people think that they have power and that words have power, and if you can restrict what people can read, you can control their thoughts, tells you how powerful they are. And Alberto Manguel said in his book about reading, and he has a whole chapter on restricted and banned reading. And the first page, and you see a photo of a slave reading outside of a cabin. And as he says, and I can almost memorize this, as dictators, slave owners, and other illicit holders of power have known, an illiterate crowd is the easiest to rule. If you cannot prevent people from learning to read, the next best recourse is to limit its access. And that's what, when you look at people who are saying, don't read this, I don't want other people to look at this information, what they're doing is also limiting the opportunity for people to think for themselves and make their own opinions about what they read.
Now, we're going to come to some of the banned books that you've been thinking about and have brought with you. We'll talk about in a minute.
Captain Underpants is banned. Or wants to be. People want Captain Underpants removed. Not the underpants, but the book from elementary school.
Right. And we'll get to that in a minute. We'll talk about Captain Underpants and Sean Alexie's book. And Barbara Jones, nationally, this is still going on. One of the things we said at the very top of this hour, I got a message from a friend in North Carolina, who used to be a state delegate here, who's now minister, Wendell Phillips, who's in North Carolina, about the Randolph County, North Carolina, that banned Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man.
Yes.
Just recently.
Right. Yes. Our office defends all books that are removed from shelves of libraries, but this one particularly hurts because, as Carla said so eloquently, books help people to think for themselves. Books are powerful, no question about it. And as I review banned books over the years, it is really clear to me that people try to restrict access to a lot of these very powerful books about the African American experience, about the Mexican American experience, and the Native American experience. And I don't think it's an accident that that some of these excellent, powerful books, that some people try to restrict them, because they help people understand their own particular history that many of us didn't get when we were in high school and college. And so we try to defend the right to read, the freedom to read for all people, and so that nobody in this country is invisible in terms of the written word, in terms of their story.
And how did that story play out for you in Maryland, David Rocha?
Well, we've had our share of controversies over the year, and I, in preparation for today's show, compiled a list going back a number of years. And the common theme here in Maryland seems to be sexuality and sexual orientation, which I would add. I mean, I completely agree with what the others have said, but to add to the list of categories that people seem to want to repress, sexuality and sexual orientation would be another big category. And I can run down the list if you're interested. In 2011, the Bel Air High School, the drama club was going to be performing a play called Almost Maine by John Cariani. And the head of the performance department for the school system there told them that they couldn't perform one scene in the play, a scene called They Fell, which is a scene in which two male friends realize that they're in love with each other. There were other scenes in the play that dealt with heterosexuality. Those were fine, but because this dealt with homosexuality, they sought to censor it.
2 years ago in Harford County.
2 years ago in Harford County. And we sent a demand letter, and they very quickly backed down. Another issue that perhaps not directly what we're talking about today, but I think extremely closely related, is the use of filtering software in schools and in libraries. And we have done work around the state through public records requests to find out what filtering software different school districts are using. And in Harford County, again, in 2010, I guess there's a common theme here, we found that their filtering software called Bluecoat gave the school system the option to block any one or more of 60 categories. And they had chosen to block the category LGBT, which is not a category of sexually explicit web content, but they are explicitly told what you're blocking is content about LGBT issues. And what was really interesting was they had only blocked the content. They had not blocked anti-gay content. So the websites about so-called reparative therapy sites that had content that was opposed to lesbian and gay equality, those were fine. But sites that promoted lesbian and gay equality were blocked. Again, we sent a demand letter, and they backed down. Going back to 2008, parents asked the Calvert County Public Library to remove And Tango Makes Three, a book that frequently appears on the American Library Association's most banned list. It's a true story about two male penguins who foster and raise a chick. And there's a great fear, apparently, of gay penguins.
Penguins, they're very dangerous.
What were you going to say, Barbara?
Well, And Tango Makes Three was at the top of the list, or on the list, for many years. I was shocked that it wasn't there this year. And whenever I tell this to a group of students or a group that I'm speaking to, there's just this gasp in the room that anybody would attack this book. But indeed, it is attacked. I also agree with everything that was said about filtering. This is a new kind of censorship that we are struggling with. It is an invisible, insidious kind of censorship, because often users don't know what they're missing. And it's a deep concern to our office as well.
And people, when they think about filtering, people who are looking for just basic health information, if you want to look up, for instance, breast cancer, there are some filters that will not let you look up breast cancer.
Because of the word breast.
Right, because of the word breast. So it has so many implications beyond just thought, but just basic life safety and things that you might want to know. And when you think about young people, a lot of these books that are challenged and even banned, as you notice, there's a theme there for young people, children and teens, and especially for teens when they need information the most, when they need to find out that they're not alone, when they need to read about other experiences. This is when you start to say you can't read about another teen that might be thinking about their identity. That's frightening.
Yes.
Come back into the conversation. Come into the conversation, Krista.
Well, one thing that I've heard from some public school students who try to access our publisher's website is that it's blocked through their filters as either terroristic or pornographic material.
AK Press, your
yes.
press, your
book. And while certainly many of the books that we carry are, you know, incendiary in a theoretical sort of way or in a historical context, we're not giving out material that is dangerous in any other way. And students actually aren't able to access our website because of that.
Which from the schools?
Yes.
Does that happen in the state as well?
I'm not sure about Maryland, but I've heard it from multiple states in the United States and then also especially from the UK.
So,
and the I should say that on that issue of web censoring in schools, the ACLU has had a national campaign called Don't Filter Me, where ACLU affiliates around the country have done what we did here in Maryland and sent public records requests out to school districts to find out what filtering software they're using and what criteria they're using to block. And the ACLU has done advocacy all over the country to address exactly this kind of issue.
So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888, almost forgot, I remember for a minute, 410-319-8888, to join. That was almost banned. Don't ban the number, call it. And give us your thoughts on banned books. I mean, there are books out here that have been banned. And when I said it was complex, and I don't want to get narrow into this because that's not where most of it happens, but there are books that are banned, like people didn't want to say we can ban Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer because of the use of the N-word in the book. So we should ban that book or take the word out. I mean, there's a whole period where that word was going to change. We're going to change the word in the book to change the way it was written so people didn't read the word. I mean, so there's from that to the kind of just kind of gross overlapping of what's this? Books banned. Yes, right. This is a great piece in Banned Books Week that I was looking on the web and Carla just handed me. And it's a page with all these words blackened out on a page, and the only words left were discover what you're missing.
That's our design for this year.
It's a great design.
Yes. And if you buy the coffee mug, the words are there, and they disappear, and they come back, depending on how hot your coffee is.
But so what do you think, what is the fear? Whether it's the fear of Tom Sawyer or the fear of the invisible man, which are very different reasons why, and then there's things that are more overtly political, like what's happening in Arizona, which we'll talk about, which I think is important to address. Where is this coming from? What's your analysis of why this is happening?
I think there are a lot of reasons why it's happening. I think some parents are genuinely afraid and think that if they keep a book from their children, it will prevent their children from looking at history and at the past. And, of course, that doesn't work. We understand the sentiment, but it simply doesn't work. There are other reasons, I think. I think we've talked about the LGBT experience, people's anxiety about current events here in this country. I mean, it's clear to many of us where things are going in terms of gay marriage and in terms of the whole LGBT experience becoming part of the United States experience. People are anxious about that, and I think a lot of it's anxiety. I mean, why would Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich be on the list? I think it's because people are afraid to deal with class differences in this country and with people who work for an hourly wage. I think there are a lot of different and complex reasons, but a lot of it is just a fear of the unknown, something that people haven't thought of, or a lot of times I think people have a real fear of how things are going in the country and think that somehow they can play a small part in preventing change by removing a book, because it's easier to do than, let's say, a revolution. So those are some of the reasons that I think.
And Barbara, I'm jumping in on this too,
sure.
In terms
Paula
of
Hayden.
Just as a former children's librarian and knowing that at a very basic level there are a lot of adults that are very uncomfortable and don't know how to answer children's questions or talk to children about these things that they might see and things like that. So if they can just narrow the child's vision, maybe they won't ask mommy or daddy or what's going on or something like that. So that's even at a very elementary level, but some of it is even motivated just by that. I don't know how to talk to my kids about it, so let's not let them know about it.
Good point.
So 410-319-8888 is the number here. I'm really glad you should join us. I mean, do you think books should be banned in your school library? I mean, would you support any of that? I'd like you to know. Tell us, 410-319-8888. Maybe you fought against it. We'd like to hear about that. But what books shouldn't they read? Are you worried about books that have the N-word in it? Are you worried about Captain Underpants, which we'll talk about in a moment? And other books that when we come back from this break. So 410-319-8888. How's that work in your school? Maybe you go to a public school, maybe a private school, maybe a religious school, a Christian academy, or a Jewish school or a Muslim school. 410-319-8888. What are the rules in your libraries? Do you know? Do you care? 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We are here with Dr. Carla Hayden, Chief Executive Officer of the Enoch Pratt Library, Dr. Barbara Jones, Director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association, David Rokaw, ACLU Maryland's Senior Staff Attorney, Krista Daring, publicist at AK Press, collective member at Red MS Bookstore and Coffee House, co-editor of the book Queering Anarchism, 410-319-8888 number here. Your favorite banned books. Do you think we should be banning books? Should our access be limited? What do you think? So we do have to get to this one piece I have to ask about since you raised it as soon as you walked in the door, Carla. Captain Underpants.
One of the most popular series for middle school students out. It started in 1997, and it's about, and I'll just say, George and Harold, best friends, a young black boy and a young white boy. They had a lot in common, as the book said. They live right next to each other, and they were both in the same fourth grade class at Jerome Horitz Elementary School. And they were actually nice boys, but sometimes they weren't so sweet and lovable. And over the years, they had created hundreds of their own comics starring dozens of their own superheroes. And then George came up with an idea. Most superheroes look like they're flying around in their underwear. Well, this guy is actually flying around in his underwear. And he said, and Harold said, yeah, he could fight with wedgie power. And so George and Harold spend entire afternoons writing and drawing the comic adventures of Captain Underpants. He was the coolest superhero ever. And then what happens is Mr. Crump, the meanest, sourest old principal in the whole history of Jerome Horace Elementary School, hated laughter, singing, sounds of children playing at recess. In fact, he hated children altogether. And guess which two children Mr. Crump hated most of all? George and Harold. And guess who turns into Captain Underpants in their comic books? So you're talking about subversion. You're talking about these comic books and all of this
stuff. Interracial friendship, too.
Oh, well, please. As soon as you saw the picture of George and Harold being happy together, you knew that was a downer right there. And then the fact that they make the Mr. Crump, who didn't like children, into Captain Underpants, who... through the wonder of imagination, doesn't know that he turns into Captain Underpants at night and has all of these adventures with George and Harold. You could imagine kids loving this. But it's the number one this year book that's
the number one book
to be challenged.
And what kind of places are banning it?
Oh, Barbara, you could take it away.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Who's banning that book?
Okay, parents in various school systems, because of the potty humor, and there is a lot of potty humor in the Captain Underpants series. And what is really incredible to me is if it's one universal joke that everybody can share, and that's potty humor, and it doesn't hurt people in terms of ethnicity or anything. It's universal, and also, parents love to read these books to their children, and that's one thing that I've learned from this whole controversy is there are a lot of parents out there who are just astounded because this was one kind of book that they could read with their kids, and the parents can roll their eyes and the kids can giggle and share the experience together. So those are some of the reasons, and parents as well as kids are just scratching their heads about this one.
410-319-8888, your thoughts. And, you know, it's also that some of the books that are being banned, I mean, some of them are, before we go back to some of the other ones that have been banned and why, certain things are being banned, like Romeo and Juliet and a bunch of school systems were banned because it was too overtly sexual for middle school kids to read.
And that's interesting about Shakespeare, about being overt. If you've read Shakespeare, sometimes you have to dig a little deep.
You do have to think a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, right. You do.
So, but another piece of Shakespeare that was banned was part of the banning of books in Arizona. They banned The Tempest, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This whole thing about killing, the state legislature in Arizona decided that there would be no longer more, Chicano studies were out of their high schools.
Yes.
Out of their schools. We're done with it. But then as we were talking earlier, Krista, they not only ban that, but then they decided to ban all the books to go with it.
Yeah, so they actually only banned 7 books from the classroom proper through the English courses, but then they eliminated the ethnic studies program, which effectively banned over 65 other books from the Tucson Unified School District. And so what they were able to do is they can still sort of waffle a little bit and say, oh, we might have them in the library, but we might not. They're not really banned. Instead, we've just eliminated an entire program. And the reason that they gave for that was that the program was intensifying ethnic or racial tension and resentment. What's so funny about this is that is to say, oh, well, it's the books that made racial and ethnic resentment exist, not, you know, an unreasonable and unstabilized system of white supremacy and oppression.
Right.
Let's just forget about all that.
Yeah, it's the book's fault.
I mean, it were books like Critical Race Theory, Rethinking Columbus, even Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which was already banned in America in the early 70s for a while. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get a copy.
I need to give a shout-out here to Tony Diaz and his Libro Traficante movement. Mm-hmm. If you Google Libro Traficante, Tony has been going from city to city. He started in Arizona. He started in Tucson with collecting all the books that were banned in the schools in Tucson, taking them around in a station wagon and handing them out to kids. And this has become a nationwide movement with programs in many major cities this week during Banned Books Week. So I want to give Tony a real shout out. He's a real hero.
So how do you spell that?
LibroTraficante. Libro Traficante. And it's Book Bandit.
Book Bandit.
He's going around. He's a real outlaw. I just love Tony. He's really helping all of us get a real sense of how invisible Latinos have been in this country in terms of the coverage in books and availability of books in libraries and elsewhere. And a real hero.
We'll have to get him on the air with us.
Yeah. He's a fabulous speaker. You'd love him.
Let's do that. Stephanie Nodger has yes. She's got that. All right. We'll get him on the air with us. We have folks joining us here on Facebook. You can join us at 410-319-8888. Tyrone writes in, I know why the caged bird sings and Invisible Man were banned. Why?
Oh, my goodness.
Think?
Well, I know why.
He didn't say why. He says he knows why, but why do you think why?
Well, I know that I've heard some of the reasons, mainly that it was too graphic, even though it was, for instance, Maya Angelou's own story.
Yeah.
Okay, this is telling her own story, and that's things happened to her. But that's one of the reasons why that was decided as something that young people shouldn't read, even at a time when some of those same young people might be going through some of the same things.
I mean, I read Invisible Man for the first time when I was probably 13 or 14, and it was just this remarkable book. And certainly I didn't find this in my school library. This was given to me by my father. But
good father.
Know, the introduction to black nationalism and Marxism were incredibly important and amazing. And to deprive youth of that reading experience is just insanity to me.
Also, it's interesting, and Barbara, I'd be interested in your input, too, on this, that a lot of the books that feature violence are not challenged as much. Mm-hmm.
It's right. I find it really ironic that, there are cultural differences from country to country and from region to region about what is offensive to people. And when I do a lot of training overseas on intellectual freedom. And what always, the question that always comes up is, why is your country so accepting of violence on television or wherever, and so uptight about sex? And because I remember being in Ecuador in a mountain village where they are trying really hard to recapture the indigenous culture and language and the music. And they have these wonderful little folklore booklets, beautifully illustrated for the kids. And lo and behold, there are genitals in these books of folklore for little kids, and they would be banned.
Not genitals.
The horror.
Who has those?
And somehow these little kids, and I'm talking little kids, reading these books in grade school in this little village in Ecuador, somehow they remain unharmed by this experience. You know, so it is a tendency in this country that we are more accepting of violence than of sex.
410-319-8888, ban books. Is it that important to you? What are your thoughts on it? How does that fit into your own life in schools and libraries? Are there books that you do not want to read yourself or have your children read for certain reasons? I'm curious. Ray Davis writes in, unfortunately, the term banned books may become an oxymoronic statement so far as we have chosen to read less of anything of substance. Typically, democracy itself is at stake when that has happened. As I am often in Barnes & Noble, I see very few people taking reading and more than self-help stuff. Ironically, I hope that we might have discussions about banned books 20 years from now as proof that reading is still a passion for the many.
Well, it's also interesting that the primary locus of the fights about banning books is libraries or the internet, which is really the world's biggest library. And it shows you the power of libraries and librarians, that it's this incredibly democratizing institution that has opened up knowledge to people who otherwise wouldn't have access to it, and allowed people to see things that you otherwise wouldn't see. And the fight, I think, the reason the fight goes there is because it's also, I think, a lot of the examples we've been talking about, it's a method of social control. There's a desire to control what other people will see and read and learn about in order to reinforce positions in society. And so I think that's why you see the concern about sexuality. I think that's why you see the concern about the overt political censorship trends. And it's an attempt to reinforce and enshrine existing social structures from the reality or the knowledge that could challenge them. And that's why libraries are so powerful, that's why books are so powerful, and that's why these battles come up over and over again and why we have to be vigilant to fight them.
Well, there's an email here I want to read, and then we're going to hear a little piece of tape, a short piece of tape that my producer, Stephanie Mavrone, has just found of a liberal Trafficante speaking.
Oh,
so we'll put that up there in just a second.
Great.
But let me read email in here from Mark. It writes, my parents always made any books from their collection available to me to read and never gave me a hard time for reading them. They also encouraged me to take any books out of the library that I wanted, which meant that by the time I was 11, I had read Erica Jong, Eldridge Cleaver, Henry Miller, Kurt Vonnegut, Valerie Solanas, Stephen King, Allen Ginsberg, and Amiri Baraka. That meant I read a lot of erotic, political, and violent things at a young age. It also meant that I got a deeper understanding of sex, politics, and violence than some of my peers who were exposed to those things, to it, but via TV and movies. Parents aren't going to keep kids from being exposed to sex and violence, but by keeping them from reading books that deal with these things, they can keep them from being exposed to nuanced analysis on sex and violence.
Wow, bravo.
That was wonderful. Thank
you. Interesting thought.
Yes. I really like that comment. It resonates with me because my parents let me read whatever I wanted, and my mother, in fact, went down to my local small-town public library and banged her fist on the desk and said, you will let her into the adult section. So I think that, again, it is a method of social control, no question about it. And I would love, and I have over the years talked to many, many people who were allowed to read whatever they wanted to, and none of them seem maimed by that experience. They seem to have been enriched.
And one of the things that people might not realize about young people reading, when you get to the sections that you don't understand, you just kind of skim it. You say, oh,
absolutely.
I don't know what that is, but it's interesting, and you keep going. It's
right.
Not the type of thing that you're going to study it and go into it. So looking at what libraries can offer, you might also want to think about when the budgets are cut for
libraries,
that public access and libraries and where that's headed, it's interesting because you're cutting off that access.
There's so many libraries I've learned in the country that are not publicly funded in many places across America. Enoch Pratt is partially publicly funded.
Right.
But it means also that the libraries across the country are now thrown out to the vagaries of the marketplace where they have to raise money in order to keep things going and rebuild and keep branches open. And that's the kind of shows the importance we put or don't put on access to books.
Yeah, there's a cartoon going around with my Facebook friends right now saying that, you know, if a library is closed and you have no access, there are no banned books. So absolutely, I mean, we have to keep our libraries open.
Let's play this clip that that Stephanie, it's a very short clip that Stephanie said. Let's just play this clip from that we just spoke about, Libro Trafficante, and see what he sounds like.
My name's Tony. You might have heard that Arizona had the audacity to ban Latino studies. Well, I'm here to introduce a few new words into the lexicon of Arizona, courtesy of the Protester's Handbook, written right here in Houston, Texas. First phrase, Libro Trafficante. Me and my fellow Libro Traficantes will be smuggling contraband books back into Arizona this spring break, March 2012. If you want to get involved, visit the website, LibroTraficante.com.
Wonderful.
Actually, let's get into it.
Talk about
smuggling banned books. I love it.
Smuggling books. If we had more smugglers of books,
that's
pretty good.
Well, it's sort of interesting to see how the banning of books has evolved in the United States. Initially, it was the U.S. Postal Service that did a lot of the censoring, and they would say that a book is unmailable because of its vulgarity of its content. And now that we have the internet and this readily available bookstore opportunities, it's moving more and more to actually being sanctioned directly by the government or by schools instead of, you know, someone sitting at the post office and saying, nope.
Right.
Yeah.
One other interesting controversy here in Maryland that I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that's actually live right now is not in libraries, not in schools, but in prisons, where our State Department of Corrections here has adopted a policy recently that says prisoners cannot get books unless they are pre-approved by the prison administration and can't order books directly from the publisher. And our view is that that policy is unconstitutional. We're looking into it right now. But the link between book banning and social control is, I think, particularly clear in that context.
Well, I mean, but that is really what it is. The bottom line of book banning is, call it,
control.
Social control.
And think That's about Malcolm X when he was in jail and the reading he did and how that helped shape his later activities. And so to not give people information when they are even more controlled is, well, I want to say criminal.
I know. It reminds me of a recent workshop I did in a maximum security women's prison here in Illinois. And there is a woman in that prison who is getting her doctorate through a program that the University of California offers for her, offers for prisoners. But she is unable to get the books she needs to study from the prison library. And so a bunch of her friends send them through Amazon, and I don't want to reveal too much here and get people in trouble, but the books are kind of smuggled in to her.
As they should be.
Yeah.
And you think of what materials that the people who are incarcerated are looking at are not going to encourage further criminal activity. It might actually be helpful.
Right. I mean, I think people would be shocked that actually the books she's looking for are about the French Revolution. I don't think, you know, people have a stereotype of, well, you know, prisoners only want a certain kind of book. And it's just totally not true. A lot of people in prison want to change their lives and in various ways through education.
Well, also in Maryland, political prisoner Marshall Eddie Conway, AK Press published his memoir, Martial Law, in 2011. It was promptly banned by the Maryland Department of Corrections. And through a lot of really amazing work and in organizing and protest, the book is now allowed back in prisons. But it's interesting that his memoir, he wasn't allowed to read his own memoir when he was incarcerated. And he runs a literacy program that he uses his memoir for that program, and they said you can't have it.
So tell me from your perspectives, I mean, how deep and real is this, is the issue of banned books?
Well, I think it is very real and very deep, and when you look at the fact that Toni Morrison's books,
like Beloved,
Beloved and Other, are also challenged. And what is that saying about a culture that doesn't want people to expand their minds and their opportunities? So it is deep. It's not Captain Underpants is funny and we can laugh about that, but the larger issues are very real, and I think they are going very parallel to other things that are happening, especially in this country.
David?
I think it, you know, it's one of these things that requires constant vigilance. I think the impulse to control others, the impulse to limit what they read and see and learn about is constant. That's why the battles on this are constant. And I, you know, that's why I read the list of recent battles just here in Maryland. And Maryland is better than most states. But it's something that comes up periodically. I think usually we win these battles because I think the effort to censor what other people read and think. Look, the other thing to say and remember is if you don't want to read something,
yes,
there's a very, very easy solution.
Yes.
Don't read it.
Read it.
No one is trying to force any book on anybody. If
Absolutely.
you don't like something,
yes,
don't read it.
But how do you stop? I'm sorry, I'm going to say,
and parents can decide, and that's their right,
yes,
what their own children
right
read
exactly
or not.
Right,
right.
They don't have the right to determine what other people's children
exactly
read.
So how do you stop a Randolph County, North Carolina, from banning a book like The Invisible Man? Just because that just came up the other week. I mean, how do you stop? I mean, that, so it is. I mean, that kind of outrage in terms of stopping a book from coming in, one of the great classics of American literature, people have been fighting for years to be in the canon for all students to read. How do you address that?
Well, thank God we've got sort of a free press, because this has become a national issue. I did a Huffington Post article about it yesterday. It really struck a nerve in me. I'm a baby boomer who read it, and there have major civil liberties groups yesterday sent a letter to the board, and they are going to reconsider their decision on the 25th. And I think it's really important that people who are outraged by this write to them or write letters to their editors, or because there has been a lot of coverage of this, and all of it has been really negative. And so perhaps some people on the board will change their mind. I hope so.
And this is the piece that you wrote that Carla just handed to me about readouts.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we have a banned book readout every year now. If you go to our website, www.ala.org/bbooks, you can contribute a readout, a video of yourself or a group of friends or a class reading, and you could read from Invisible Man. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because there is a young woman in that town where the book is being banned who is going to read the book out loud. I don't know how much of it, but there are ways to stand up and protest. And if I may, I want to talk about the really important role of students, of high school and college students here. We had a group here, have a group here in Chicago called the 451 Club at Lane Tech High School. It's a public school. 451 refers to Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury.
Right,
and
right.
These kids read banned books, and they were out in the streets protesting. 700 students protesting the removal of Persepolis from the Chicago Public Schools curriculum last year, and it was quite powerful. And
Chicago.
We need to get students involved. It's in many cases the books are being taken from their hands, and they need to be made aware of this. And so I'm always delighted to meet teachers who celebrate Banned Books Week in high school or middle school.
There's a line here I have to read, and it says that this year we're seeing a Banned Books Week dance performed in Muhlenberg College, Pennsylvania. Twitter parties, a Google Hangout with Sherman Alexie at a BBQ&A in Austin, Texas, and another local author in Indianapolis is going to live at the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library behind a storefront featuring a wall of banned and challenged books. These things are going on across the country. And maybe what we should do is have a caravan, a Ralph Ellison Invisible Man caravan, and take a ride down to North Carolina and have a whole stack of these books to give out to people.
That's right.
New Freedom Riders.
The Freedom Riders.
Yeah, it was sold out right now. A local bookstore near where it was banned said they've just reordered 200 copies. I mean, that's the other ironic part of this, is Invisible Man, in a way now, people are going to be aware of it. It was published in 1952, and here we go. We will all be reading it again, which is a good thing.
Well, this is to me has been an important discussion we've just had here today, and all the commentaries and Libro Traficante and the articles that on Huffington Post and more will all be posted on steinershow.org when we post this show today up there. So people will have a chance to kind of Google all that and see it. Read it, hit it, and see what's going on. This is really important, and I'm glad we did it. And it's great to see Dr. Carla Hayden here in the studios, and we'll have to make this a regular visit, Carla.
Right. All banned books.
All banned books. CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library, Dr. Barbara Jones, Director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association, David Rokha, ACLU Maryland Senior Staff Attorney, Krista Daring, Publisher at AK Press, Collective Member at Red MS Bookstore and Coffee House. We'll be working this weekend at the festival coming up.
Baltimore Book Festival.
Well, thank you all for being here. And join me this Sunday, by the way, at 2 p.m. at the Radical Book Fair Pavilion at the Baltimore Book Festival. I'll be moderating a conversation with Carl Alperovitz, Dr. Lester Spence, and Maryland State Senator Jamie Raskin. We'll be talking about Alperovitz's book, What Then Must We Do?, about the future of capitalism in America and workers' co-ops and more, and ask difficult questions about our economy, corporate capitalism, and alternatives for the 21st century. So join us there. You can go to BaltimoreBookFestival.com to find out more. A lot of incredible. James McBride, who I interviewed yesterday on the show, will be there on Saturday at 3, one of my favorite authors, amazing thinker that we're lucky to have to do. So please join us there. And also reminding you, the WEA's Fall Membership Drive begins October the 12th through the 20th. And we're in need of pledge room volunteers for this program and all of our other programs. To volunteer, please call 443-885-2075. Volunteer, 443-885-2075. 2075. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back from this break, we jump into sound bites. This week, we have a very special edition that we are working with the Center for a Livable Future at Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. This episode is Hungry in the Richest State, why one out of eight Marylanders face hunger in the state of Maryland. And we did an hour-long story on that. That's coming up next in the hour, so stay with us. We'll be right back.